Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. As we're nearing the end of the year, I have another episode from our Reagan Defense Forum series that we recorded early in the month. My guest is Shift CEO and Navy vet, Mike Slaw. Shift is building a massive platform for helping millions of vets transition their talent and skills to the civilian sector over the next 5 years. Critically for us here at The Realignment, though, Mike and Shift also put on the Defense Venture Summit back in DC last month. The event had a bunch of great talks from previous Realignment guests like A16Z's Catherine Boyle. We've linked some of the best of those talks in the show notes, so definitely go check those out on YouTube. The key summary of Mike's work is that it fits under his idea of what civil-military fusion in the United States could look like. We usually hear about the concept of civil-military fusion when it comes to the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army back in China. In this usage, however, I think it's an optimistic vision of how we could come together as a society, vet and civilian alike, to solve and approach big challenges this decade. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and once again, a huge thank you as we near the end of the year for the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Mike Slaw, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall. Longtime listener, first time caller.
Yeah, and I am a recent binger, I think is the way I'll put it, because I saw the Defense Venture Summit. The videos were incredible. The production was great. We're going to have a link in the show notes. Everyone needs to really check it out. But I think the first thing folks are going to notice when they check out the Defense Venture Summit is they're going to be confused by what the org you run, Shift, actually is, because, you know, shift.org, I always thought it was like a nonprofit. Normally, like, this stuff isn't relevant, but what actually is Shift, given the kind of confusing nomenclature?
Yeah, a venture-backed technology company, Delaware C Corp, our lead investors, Andreessen Horowitz, and we've got, you know, great support from a bunch of other VCs. Honestly, you know, I really like the name Shift, and there was a car company back when I was registering the domain name when we got off the ground. You know, Shift, you know, how we think about it is, you know, we started as this veteran hiring company that essentially makes it really easy for veterans to transition into technology companies. I love startups, and, you know, I spent time in the Navy, and before that I helped get a tech company off the ground. I always knew I wanted to get back into, you know, sort of the tech ecosystem. You know, but, you know, my time in the service, I was always struck. It was like, you couldn't overstate how narrow someone's perception was, you know, what they could do after the service. And these are people that I was like, these are the people you want on your side when you're trying to start something hard or do something that hasn't been done before. And so to build more pathways for veterans to break into technology companies really was how we got our start. And, you know, as we placed, you know, veterans at VC firms and VC-backed companies, that's really the sort of the origin story of how Defense Ventures is born.
You know, it's interesting. I'll just ask, this will be a no particular order episode. This is just me asking everything. I'll probably phone it in and give us like Mike Slaw on everything, which is, by the way, listeners, when a podcast calls a podcast titles an episode, that means they really threw everything at the wall and they don't have a coherent whole, but this will be coherent. First question, better path for a veteran, getting an MBA or joining a tech company or a VC firm? I ask this because I remember back in like 2009, like Forbes or Fortune had like an article. It was basically like reporting for duty. It's like, hey, if you're a veteran, like get an MBA, join like a traditional company, do like the rotational track thing. MBAs in the tech world are kind of in a weird in-between space. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're not.
For sure.
What's your answer to this dynamic?
I think, you know, you always hear the advice when you're transitioning out of the military, hey, you know, your first job isn't your forever job. You know, you don't have to necessarily figure it out right away. Anytime anybody tries to go radically cross industry, like, you know, I was in healthcare, now I want to be in education, or I was in government, now I want to be in technology. Like, it really takes some time to figure out, you know, where do I fit? How do my skills translate? You know, what can I do that's valuable in the workforce? And obviously the workforce is like, it's changing really fast right now. But, you know, the thing that, you know, I feel pretty strongly about that kind of cuts against that sort of common, you know, you don't have, your first job doesn't have to be your forever job. Like, the people that know what they want in the world, like, they just typically end up having a higher chance of, you know, actually achieving that. And so, you know, the folks, like, I would never knock somebody for going to a top MBA program. You know, if it's, you know, time to really figure out, like, where do I fit? what do I want to do? I want to get sort of exposure to a bunch of different, professionals across industry. You can really do that to build a great network, and it can work out great for you. But the folks, a lot of times that happens, or that sort of trepidation to jump into the workforce, is because when you are in the military, like the private sector, the civilian world, like it feels like a speeding train. Yeah. It's just like flying by. And you have no idea what the norms are, what even the type of projects you'd work on, or how those projects get done. Like, what's a balance sheet, and like, what's the company's goals? How is it organized? And so, one of the things I've always felt strongly about is like any little taste of private sector experience while you're on active duty service, it can like radically melt away a lot of those anxieties you feel about the outside world. I was stationed in the Navy in San Diego for my whole time. And, that's like a very commercial, like a lot of like private sector activity happening out in town. But for the most part, like people in the military are in parts of America where like the government could buy the most land for the least amount of money. And it can't overstate how siloed the military experience is. And so any little bit of private sector experience, it can really go a long way in helping you figure out, oh, this is who I want to be, or this is what I want to go after. And if you know that, especially right now, and if you're interested in sort of this, I mean, what can only be described as sort of like a Cambrian explosion around defense technology, like I left the military. I've been helping, thousands. I mean, our platform has helped tens of thousands of veterans get jobs over the last few years. There's never been a better time where it's so obvious that like military embedded expertise, can really help companies that are trying to maximize their potential as partners in the work of DoD. And so like that military experience, like it's so valuable. And it's like, why spend 2 years like hanging out and, going to, random like themed decade parties when you can just get into it right now and you can start building your path. And so if you know what you want to do, I would skip the MBA. Long winded, but I'm talking.
But this is the definition of a news you can use section.
All right.
I was just in Oklahoma because my sister-in-law just got promoted to captain. She's in the artillery in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
And she is not thinking this way. So Hannah, this is all for you.
We got you, Hannah.
We got you. This is once again very personal as you can use section.
Yeah.
Here's a real question I have for you. So I've been asking folks like what are you doing at the RNDF, Reagan National Defense Forum? But for you personally, your presence here is really interesting on a couple levels. So A, it's coming after your big summit, which of course we'll talk about, but B, it's also happening when the broader Silicon Valley position towards defense and national security at an institutional level, maybe not every single individual worker is clearly changing. Like if this were 2015, 2016, that'd be a little shocking, but obviously, I actually just DM'd you on Twitter saying, hey, like, you're going to be here, right? And you're like, yeah. So give me like your version of that, like why it's not surprising that you're here, but it would have been surprising that someone like you would be here 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think I would frame that through, defense technology, say for a couple of OGs, the Palantir, the SpaceX, the Anduril, and sort of the firms that back them and a few other like success stories, like hasn't really been considered like a VC backable, VC investable category, even up to like, I don't know, maybe like 2 years ago. We can talk about the summit more, but our Defense Ventures Summit, it brings together technologists, founders that want to start companies in the defense space that, maybe they weren't called to the mission, for the first couple companies, venture capitalists that are interested to do more in the category, and then military members who are really interested in getting acquiring the best technology into the military. Like there's a lot of companies that they build a great airplane, but you don't want them like building the AI technology that like secures the nation, or the cyber technology that like secures all the infrastructure. Like we need like the companies that are getting, it's like, that's where the innovation is coming from right now. It's technology. It used to come a lot from DOD. I appreciate DARPA giving us the internet, but
the big one,
that's the big one. Yeah. That's the example. We need a few more of those, but, so I think that what I can only describe right now is happening is a Cambrian explosion in defense technology, technology that supports safety, national security. You know, firms are trying to figure out, okay, what's our stance on this? I actually hear from a lot of LPs, of VC firms saying like, hey, who are you looking at right now? Or what type of firms are really serious about this? And so, in some ways, at the intersection of defense and technology through our fellowship, we found ourselves a little bit at the center of the storm. But I was shocked that 110 VC firms showed up at the Defense Ventures Summit. Like, I didn't know there was 110 firms who are even interested in the category. And I've been trying to do, bring these two worlds together for 4 years. And so that's this at RNDF. It's my first time. I'm trying to soak it in, trying to talk to people, ask other companies, hey, why do you come back? Like, how has the event, sort of changed over the years? There's a lot more startups and VC backed companies out here, than there ever have been. But I think I would say that the perception that, you talk to a lot of military people, a lot of government folks, and oftentimes, they're really either A, they've got this problem where there's just a tremendously low, high quality signal to noise ratio. Like, they're getting it, government people are getting inundated by a bunch of things that aren't the next Anduril, the next Epirus, the next Shield, the next Scale, all this really vibrant, technology industrial base that we are going to need. It's starting to develop. It's just a bunch of noise right now. And so the government, and the military, the people that want to actually purchase the best technology in America and the best technology from our allies, their number one problem is connectivity to the other side. And it turns out, for this tidal wave of new founders that are entering the space, new VCs that are entering the space, military veterans who feel like they want to build in this space as well. It's connectivity into the DoD. Mm-hmm. Where do I spend my time? There's 3 million person organization with thousands of people who do commercialization or public private interface and things like that. And so it's there has to be, some sort of comprehensive tech integration in between both sides. We embed military people into startups and VC firms so they can accelerate their path and be with technologists and understand what good looks like in technology. At the same time, these technologists, they get to, work and develop a meaningful relationship with somebody in the military. That may sound kind of obviously, but it's you'd be shocked. We were talking about an example of how, at Anduril, they've done a great job of bringing in recent veterans from, a bunch of different military communities, special operations, and they have this embedded military expertise where they're just oh, the drone's going to break if you take it into this type of environment, or, this is a constraint that we're up against, and that's not obvious stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, going back to the MBA example, there's never been a time, at least in the technology sector, where military experience has ever meant more, has been, more valued in the workforce, which, I think that's a reprieve for some folks, where it's veterans in some ways have been treated as this charity.
Yeah.
For two decades. And it's, we'll try and bring some vets in and we'll put them in the special program. At least in this sector, those days are over. This is a place where, if you were excellent in your job in the military and for whatever reason, you got family or you don't want to move around anymore, or you're just ready for something new. I think about this as sort of reframing, retention for the military services. Isn't it great if somebody, if they retire or if they leave service for whatever reason, if they are building the technology companies, if they are the VC firms that are investing in these technologies, those are obviously the people that we want, helping bridge the gap with the Department of Defense. So a bunch of stuff I'm excited about right there. And that's why I'm here, because this is obviously our RNDF, you look around and it's a different level of seniority. It is in different organizations that, maybe they don't communicate so well. It's a bunch of really senior leaders, but this is a place where they come and coordinate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you see, you know, all the service secretaries, all the, you know, General Alvin's here and SecDef is here. CNO is here. It's wild to sort of see that, because that's not what the Defense Venture Summit was about. You know, the Defense Venture Summit was about, you know, a bunch of, you know, more, you know, relatively, you know, more junior than 4-star military folks. There's not too many of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, you know, people who are desperate to sort of fulfill their potential as technologists in the military. And that, you know, kind of means something different today than it did even like, you know, 6 months or a year ago. But they want the best technology. Like, they're sick of, you know, legacy systems and not having the best. Like, it's, you know, they don't want to live in the world
yeah.
the way it is right now.
Something I'm curious about, and this is a tension both at your summit, but also in most of the books about like the like arsenal democracy back in the 1940s. Bill Knudsen, you know, Henry Kaiser, these are the paragons of who you would imagine a tech founder or a tech VC would want to be in the case of, let's say, a great power conflict. In a lot of these books, they'll even say something like, just as in a book, you'll have like a section trying to make a history book relevant for today. And they'll say something like, anyone thinking about how Silicon Valley could be useful to America and the way that the auto industry was useful to America in World War II should read this book, blah, 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 blah. And the pause I always give, because I work in these two worlds, is I understand the direct tie between, let's say, Bill Knudsen building up GM and the factory production line. And the central challenge is like, hey, how do we build a B-24 Liberator in the course of a few days versus a few weeks, which the Nazis and Imperial Japan can't match? I see how you would translate that to the military when you switch to like from autos to Sherman tanks. I don't quite see where a lot of the high-performing tech startup founders I know, incredibly mission-oriented, incredibly accomplished, but these are just fundamentally different challenges. I'd be curious, like, what your kind of response to this kind of shift in dynamic, where does SV, as America's top industry, kind of fit into the World War II metaphor? That's a lot, so you don't have to have a perfect reaction, but I just, whenever I hear it, I sort of say, but a SaaS company, even the, and this isn't dunking on SaaS companies, SaaS is not to World War III as auto industry is to World War II, no matter what.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think that, you know, very few people, you know, just 18 months ago, you know, we, you know, let's just think about like, I'll try to do this fast, but like, I care a lot about this. I learned about technology, you know, helping my grandma Betty, her retail toy business in Lansing, Michigan. She sold, you know, dolls and bears and had this cool community around her. You know, but you know, she got disrupted by Amazon and eBay and the secondary market. And, you know, I helped her get the whole inventory on eBay and basically took this legacy family business that, you know, she operated for 50 years. She's an entrepreneur. And like, it's like the person that I find myself channeling like all the time. But in 1999, I learned HTML and CSS, just like you could make good MySpace, you know, pages and stuff, you know, to get online with eBay. And then I took, you know, some time and, you know, went to the Naval Academy and forgot that part of myself. And then I got the chance, you know, before I actually entered the service, I was in a master's program where I had, you know, an awesome professor and a couple of, you know, ex-Army Rangers around me who wanted to, you know, start a technology company. And I knew HTML and CSS. And I got back online, and in this 10 years later, Ruby on Rails was possible. And you could have the, you know, a new way to develop web applications. And it was like the whole world shifted in 10 years. Then I went into the military, you know, went down the rabbit hole in the Navy for 7 years. I kind of forgot that technologist inside of me again. And I came back up for air in 2017 to start Shift. And all of a sudden, the recursive iteration had happened again. And, you know, Rails is great, but there was like, you know, serverless backends and all these new JavaScript frameworks. And you could do so much more with so many less people and so much cheaper. And the barrier to entry for starting a startup was so low. And then you sort of fast forward to, you know, just right before ChatGPT, you had some folks sort of like, you know, doing some cool stuff with Stable Diffusion, and you're like, whoa, like, you know, maybe this is going to be a new way for like creatives to, you know, make creative faster and that type of a thing. But like, you know, at that moment in time, like it felt like, okay, no one was talking about AI, no one was paying attention to it. But now we had the chance over the last 18 months to actually experience it and use it. And it's like, you can use it, you know, for your homework, you can use it, you can use it for like, you know, that's the hardest part, is just like remembering to incorporate it in your like daily workflow. Or, oh, hey, maybe I'll run this through this and see what I get out. But now we have 10 times or 100 times more people who are really excited about this. And now like those recursive iterations in technology, like they're really compressing like rapidly. And so it's like stuff that wasn't even possible 6 months ago, it's possible today. You know, the back end of the Ruby on Rails web application that we made, like a machine will tell me how to do that step by step, and I can build the whole, the lightweight version of the app in like 6 hours on a Saturday and a Sunday and hack it together. And I'm not, you know, I am not a software engineer, but you know, you get so much leverage from technology. And so it's like you don't have to squint very hard to see it. Okay, if the iteration went from 10 years to 7 years to 5 to 2 to 6 months, like it's moving so fast. And like that's the problem right now, that I actually struggle to communicate that simply to, like, I'm actually not the guy right now. Maybe it'll be someday. Like, I'm not talking to DoD leaders. I'm talking to service members who are trying to come to grips with technology. I'm talking to the E4, the O3, the O5, that maybe they're the only person that cares about the future of cybersecurity at Fort Liberty. Liberty now. And you connect them into this network, and they all of a sudden they found their people. And now they can go a lot faster. And now they have access to a thing that they didn't have access to before. And so, like, what's the analogy of like what could civil military fusion look like? How can Silicon Valley help DoD? Obviously it wasn't too long ago I bet there's still a lot of Americans who look at the tech sector and we're pretty disappointed that some of our leading technology companies shunned the DoD and employees walked out and stuff. Yeah. It's hard to forget the past, but you have to move forward, because like now we're witnessing this moment in time where there are so many founders and there are so many VCs who diligently want to build in the space. And so the real thing that DoD can benefit from is tech fluency. Mm-hmm. Like there's always been a fluency gap between the public and private sector, no matter what part of the public sector that you're talking about. Like we just had in the military, we just have worse software. Like it wasn't consumer grade. You go to the DMV, like it takes longer than it should. I think I am very, like, I'm always the optimist, and people are like, you're optimist to a fault. But like, the scary part for the optimist to me is that like people do not have their heads around it. The pace that is accelerating. So it's no longer about the state of the art. It's about the art of the possible.
Yeah.
The state of the art is this stagnant thing. We've achieved the pinnacle. We've reached the top of the mountain. That's not what technology looks like today. It's an art form, because it changes so rapidly every day. You see something on Twitter and you're like, whoa, now your kids can draw on an iPad and they can make this visualization. Or now, like, you don't need to like know how to do all the equations in the spreadsheet. It can really talk you through it step by step. It's radical, very optimistic about the future. But the way that getting more military members, and you know, eventually I could talk to some senior leaders, but it's like I talk to hundreds and hundreds of folks who are insufferably frustrated about the pace and the bureaucracy, and they leave because the projects that they care about, they don't move forward, or at least they don't move forward fast enough. And so exposing more and more military to technologists and to the art of the possible, it actually, I don't believe it takes that many people moving in the same direction, moving in unison, mm-hmm. to create a tremendous impact. Like, the, you know, there's 3 million people in the DoD. Is it, you know, look, you know, these technology companies create something incredible with 10 people that touches billions and billions of people. And so getting exposure to at least understanding how to ride the wave, the coming wave,
yeah.
right? That's one way at least, but.
I think that's a helpful way to frame it, because the kind of point here is I set up SV kind of unfairly with the framing, because the challenge is not that we need people who could shift a industrial plant in Michigan from autos to be 24s. To your point, an actual huge challenge is that in all these categories that are increasingly tied into national security, it's moving that quickly.
Can I say one more thing? I talked about the fluency gap. It's always been there.
Yeah.
We know that it's like kind of hard to interact with government organizations, or that, you know, anybody who served in the military, they've had their fair amount of, like, you know, it's like fix our computers was a huge thing, where it's like it you know, they timed it and it was like 30 minutes from the time you turn on your computer to the when you can send your first email, like unacceptably, like
unfathomably
bad. Yeah, exactly. Like you can't even put into words, but like, because now the pace of technology is accelerating,
yeah.
that means the fluency gap is also accelerating. And what I would ask folks to consider, or what I would ask folks to like help me like communicate it better, is oftentimes when you talk about the pace of something accelerating, the recursive iterations compressing, they get the first reaction is fear.
Yeah.
And well, I hope they don't take my job. Well, it's not inevitable. Like, AI doesn't take people's jobs. You know, AI takes, you know, people who are using AI take people's jobs who are not using it. Countries that, you know, leverage AI, you know, have tech superiority over countries that can't. And so it's like so simple, but like the first reaction is fear.
What I think the military and civilian SV can add to the set of challenges we're discussing today at RNDF is just the mission oriented nature. I mean, I think, and I'll ask you for the thing that sort of is grinding your gears, but the thing that really grinds my gears right now is that for the past few years, we in DC have had a very specific conversation of, oh, wow, we're like way too overly critically dependent on Taiwan for semiconductors. Or for the past year,
can't make a computer in America.
We still don't know how dependent we are on China when it comes to like vaccines and pharmaceuticals. If there were a conflict, which like the number is very high, but we literally don't know. I'd talk about a blockchain use case if there was one. But at the other hand, too, like we also like think of stingers. Like this isn't even about like we could do the techno babble conversation, but literal things that we could do in the 1980s and 1990s, we can't do with the defense industrial base has collapsed. I do not think civilian leadership, frankly, like at DOD has been eloquent on these issues, but also at a, like we have a civilian led military, has been effective at like conveying, here's what we need to do. Here's the timeline we need to move. And I think something that SV people are very good at, military or otherwise, is, okay, we got X amount of funding and then we moved it. I was talking to one of my Hudson colleagues, Nadia Shadlow. She helped write the 2017 national security strategy for the country. And a point she made is that her critique of the semiconductor discourse is we passed the CHIPS Act. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at what's happening in the discourse, we say, see, we passed the CHIPS Act. We have tens of billions of dollars going to this problem and we treat that as the win. And I was thinking, I was like, wait, oh my gosh, like that's just like you raising X amount of money for SHIFT. And then we're like, look at us. We've solved veteran integration into Silicon Valley. Like, but that's actually but that's quite literate. Like, we would never do that in VC. We would never say it's 2003. Well, Elon's willing to spend his PayPal money on going to Mars. Okay. We're good to go.
Yeah.
But that's actually the way civilian leadership talks about these very specific challenges. So something SV and the military wouldn't also, I think like actual like military wouldn't think that way either. So that's just a clear example of how there are just processes. And I think from both sides, it's unfathomable. I've talked to some of my friends are, you know, elected officials, like they don't really know how to think this way. But I think the military also and SV would sort of say like, wait, like obviously you wouldn't judge by the amount of money you're spending. You would look at the outcome and you look at the plan. So I think that's my, so you could answer that, but I also love to hear what the central frustration, because we're both at a bunch of notes. So I have that frustration because I spend time in the military space. Yeah. I spend time in the SV space. So I see this interconnection. You're doing your own version of that too. So like, what is a frustration that you've really developed over the past few years?
Well, I mean, you nailed it on frustration number one. There's very little I can add to that. Think about anybody that, has served, went to Afghanistan or went to Iraq. Many of us are very grateful for that experience. It forged us, like it made us who we are. It made us want to go fast. It made us, upset in a number of ways. But you can't argue that you felt like you were operating in a strategy vacuum. There was not a true north. We were not on the same page. I keep hearing the word our near peer adversaries, like the CCP, they don't have a strategy void. Everybody knows their role. Everybody knows what the game plan is. Like, it's all public. Like they publish it. Same thing as, 500 people moving with a purpose and in unison can accomplish more than a million people running around like chickens with their heads cut off. Yeah. And so you nailed it on the
framework is crazy.
Yeah.
If you think about it for 2 seconds, you're like, wait, this is kind of crazy.
Like, we're just not on the same page. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not moving in unison. Yeah. And that's part of it. I think the second part of it is just like speed. I hear, I think one of the age old adages is like, can DOD or government, but DOD, can they innovate in the absence of a crisis? Can they move fast in the absence of a crisis? We used to be able to do things fast, right? But that was because there's this existential threat in front of us.
We've kind of got it now.
That's what
it's sort of.
Yeah, no, I think that's like calling it out and understanding that like the delicacy and the literally how unsafe the world is becoming right now. We're going to have to find out if we can innovate or move fast in the absence of a crisis later, because it is a crisis now.
Yeah. Big last question here is where, I'll kind of sum up where I see you in the space right now. So it's not 2018. Mm-hmm. You would not see a Google post, once again, regardless of where people feel about the Ukraine policy itself, post-Ukraine, you would not see major tech companies refuse to work at the U.S. military to the degree with which they did during the 2010s. That's largely because I think most just normie folks saw everything the U.S. military does through the lens of our long unsettled debate about like Iraq and Afghanistan and the legacy thereof. Now, clearly, I think a lot of these debates, pro or con, are rooted in a world where things are actually happening. It doesn't just sound like when people talk about how Iran, Russia, North Korea, and China are oftentimes working together against American interests, that does not, elicit the eye roll, the axis of evil speech elicited in 2003. So the stakes are real now. So we're past 2018. You've just had this big summit. 110 venture, VCs are there. Actually, quick question on that. I know we're kind of jumping all over the place, but are there 110 companies worth funding? When you said that number, that was an instant kind of problem I kind of ran into. I'm like, oh, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think
I framed it unfair.
No, you didn't. I was just trying to what should I give away right now?
Put it a better way. Are there 110 problems that startups can disrupt and
absolutely,
solve?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, and I think because
that's different than companies formation.
Yeah, yeah. No, you think about one of the reasons why, there's this movement, VC towards defense. It's an investable category. All of a sudden, it wasn't. just even 2 years ago. Obviously, current events has a lot to do with it. The other thing is like the exit environment has sucked in the defense sector. If you got your primes are, the cost plus contracting and they're, only valued at 1 to 2x revenue. Like they can't acquire, startups, not even software margins, like at a 5x multiple, they're immediately going to get punished by the public market. And so, it's pretty easy to see, okay, Anduril will make it, Epirus will make it, Shield will make it. And now these are companies that to achieve the scale and breadth that they need to become primes, you know, software first, software enabled, fixed price contract companies. They're going to have to do a lot of acquisitions to get there. And you already see the strategy starting to play out. I think what you'll hear from some of the, I don't speak for any of those companies, but I have heard them talking about stuff like this, is like, you see a lot of, founders and VCs backing companies where it's like, it's the 55th company in this problem area. It's the 85th company. It's the, and there's this is where embedded military expertise can actually help you out, because there's actually this enormous amount of like spending priorities where, low margin services can be translated into high margin software. And it's like, the market both expands and contracts at the same time, because now that, the taxpayer is paying less money, And so, the TAM, as you get more and more, services translated into software, maybe that, contracts a little bit. But you have this huge space for, just look at all of the different, it's something I'm going to butcher it, but it's like 70 or 80, the services TAM in the world, or sort of the defense sector, like it 10x is the software TAM right now. And that's going to change.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, like VCs are interested in the sector, is like, it's if a $2 trillion market shifts 10% towards software over services, that's the same size as the global enterprise SaaS market. And so it's like, it's really big. But you want to see, a lot of the companies that, could get acquired. There are not hundreds, there are thousands of companies that need to be started in defense, but they're not all going to be
unicorns.
They're not going to be $1 to $10 billion outcomes, but, $50 million, $100 million, $200 million, like that's going to happen a lot if they're like attacking the right problem and they're going after the thing that's, it's services that can be translated into software.
So to actually close the last question then, I would say my takeaway from your conferences and Twitter X, the vibes are good. People are excited. There's energy. It's now the, okay, let's perform. The stakes are there. What do the next 2 years look like if the category that you're describing is going to perform well? Like, what metrics, to the earlier point of the conversation, like what should outsiders looking like me really know are like, okay, like X companies were funded, Y number of, X DOD are placed in companies. Like, how should we just measure what we're trying to aim for?
I'll come back to this on the, there's two things that like definitely have to exist. Like it has to be like a whole lot easier to like run software on DoD systems, on government systems than it is today. Like it's like, impossibly hard to, or impossibly expensive or impossibly long. And so, it has to be really easy to just satisfy, IL5, IL6, these different requirements to run on systems. That has to exist. And then there has to be this glue where embedded military expertise is going here, technology expertise is going there. I didn't know that I necessarily was like signing up to build a massive community business, a network. But those I'm actually super bullish on community and networks in the face of like how fast technology is moving right now, because you look at the AI companies that are really taking. They're trying to accelerate, but they're taking, they're taking precautions. Like they're working together. Like when things are existential, you work together to make sure you get it right. Like it should always be that way in defense. Like we should always work together to get things right. And so I think we have to see, both it easier to run software and easier for, the two worlds to understand each other. They actually need each other. I think we finally remember that.
I think that is a great place to end. Mike, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment at RNDF.
Thank you, Marshall. Really appreciate you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.